Hello again, and welcome back to the Slow Flowers Podcast with Deborah Prinzing, episode 293. This is the weekly podcast about American flowers and the people who grow and design with them. It's all about making a conscious choice, and I invite you to join the conversation and the creative community as we discuss the vital topics of saving our domestic flower farms and supporting a floral industry that relies on a safe, seasonal, and local supply of flowers and foliage. This podcast is brought to you by slowflowers.com, the free, nationwide online directory to florists, shops, and studios who design with American-grown flowers, and to the farms that grow those blooms. It's the conscious choice for buying and sending flowers. And thank you to our lead sponsor for 2017, Certified American Grown Flowers. The Certified American Grown program and label provide a guarantee for designers and consumers on the source of their flowers. Take pride in your flowers and buy with confidence. Ask for Certified American Grown Flowers. To learn more, visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org. Well, happy spring. I'm holding my breath, but I'm also hopeful that spring is truly here. Before we get started, I want to share some very important news, especially for all of the U.S. flower farmers listening. Every 5 years, the USDA, that's the U.S. Department of Agriculture, conducts a census, a complete count of farms and ranches and the people who operate them all across the country. This year, 2017, is an ag census year. A lot has happened in flower farming since 2012, and I strongly believe that the census metrics will reveal that. For instance, we know that from 2007 and 2012 census reports, the U.S. farms representing flowers grew 16% as a crop category. To be specific, that's a boost from 5,085 farms to 5,903 farms. I'm excited to see what the new 2017 census reveals. But here's where you come in. The folks at USDA work very hard to get the census questionnaire to everyone in farming. But as you know, it's easy for smaller or super busy farms to fall through the cracks. Well, personally, I don't think we can afford to have that happen, folks. The data report will influence policy and funding for U.S. agriculture, and I believe that flower farms need to have a much larger piece of that pie, whether that's through specialty crop block grants, value-added producer grants, or other programs that help support our industry. Producers who are new to farming or who did not receive a Census of Agriculture form in 2012 still have time to sign up to receive the 2017 form by visiting agcensus.usda.gov. That's agcensus.usda.gov. And then click on the Make Sure You Are Counted button. That'll be there through the end of June. USDA defines a farm as any place from which at least $1,000 of agricultural products were produced and sold, or normally would have been sold during the census year. And that means, unless you're a hobby grower like me, you should be counted. As I mentioned, the sign-up period ends June 30th, 2017, and all you have to do is follow the link that I'll post at deborahprinzing.com for today's show notes, episode 293, and just sign up. Then, by the end of the year, you'll receive your questionnaire, which you can leisurely complete in the middle of winter. The new census will be published in 2019, and of course, I will be here to share the highlights, hopefully with a guest from USDA to interpret it for us. Thanks so much for checking this out. This week, I'm sharing some audio that I recorded on a visit to Alm Hill Gardens. And as I say in the title of this piece, it's my favorite local tulip source. I first met flower farmers Gretchen Hoyt and Ben Kraft while working on the 50 Mile Bouquet book. And there is an interview with Gretchen in that book in the section called Grower Wisdom, with photographs by my collaborator, David Perry. If you have bought tulips at Seattle's famed Pike Place Market, it's probable that you purchased the vibrant, fresh, and lovely sustainably grown tulips from Alm Hill Gardens stall. They are my go-to stop for when I need armloads of tulips for a workshop or a demonstration. It just makes me so happy to support a local flower farm that brings its harvest direct to consumers. Here's a little bit of what I wrote in the 50 Mile Bouquet. If you follow Gretchen Hoyt and her husband Ben Kraft around for a season, you'll gain a profound admiration for how their values, sustainable farming practices, and sheer hard work produce something so ephemeral and delicate as a lilac, tulip, lily, anemone, or peony. The couple overcame many obstacles to reach this moment. When they planted their first field of raspberries in rural Everson, Washington, just 2 miles from the Washington-British Columbia border, Gretchen was a single parent of 2 young children who had escaped from the city. Ben was a veteran of the war in Vietnam who wanted to unplug from society. Ben's parents were dairy farmers. "I never grew anything until I was 26 years old," Gretchen says. "We had Ben's dad's tractor, no running water, and no power, so we started with very little at the beginning." Their efforts grew into one of the first year-round direct-selling farms in Western Washington. Today, the 47-acre property contains 6 30-by-100-foot greenhouses, countless high tunnels, hoop houses that can raise temperatures by 10 degrees, and fields of edible crops and, of course, flowers. Elm Hill Gardens is known for its luscious cut tulips, which account for 80% of their floral production. At Seattle's Pike Place Market, the sign reads, "Elm Hill Gardens, a small, sustainable family farm since 1974. And the stall overflows with irresistible blooms in a vibrant spectrum of hues to the delight of locals and tourists alike. The longer-than-usual production season, from mid-Thanksgiving to May, is possible thanks to many growing techniques perfected by the farm. These include planting already chilled bulbs so they bloom by Christmas. It means sheltering thousands of hybrid tulips in greenhouses that elevate air and soil temperatures and protect stems from Pacific Northwest rainfall. The volume of flowers required to satisfy a bulb-crazed market is mind-boggling, requiring an intensive planting system. Bulbs are planted in 12-inch-high crates and stacked for weeks like building blocks in a large walk-in cooler before being moved to the greenhouses for early spring harvesting. "We have tulip crates stacked floor to ceiling," Gretchen laughs. Elm Hill sends an employee with carloads of tulips to Seattle's Pike Place Market every week and also sells at several neighborhood farmers markets, including the Bellingham Saturday Market, which is closer to their home. Depending on the season, these brilliant gems on plump green stems can sell from $20 to $30 for a bunch of 30. You can find the classic ovoid-shaped tulip, like the orange and purple streaked Princess Irene, or more unusual varieties, such as the parrot and French tulips. Gretchen told me, "I knew I wanted to be a farmer when I finally grew a garden. This is what I was supposed to do." Well, you will hear several voices on this episode. Gretchen Hoyt and her son-in-law and farming partner, Joshua Kraft, an experienced vegetable, grain, and livestock farmer who is now deeply involved in Elm Hill Gardens, and of course me. The fourth voice is of my dear friend, Lorene Edwards-Forkner, who's editor of Pacific Horticulture, a fabulous quarterly journal that covers people and plants on the West Coast. Our day trip to Everson was so special, and I invite you to visit deborahprinzing.com to see lots of photographs of our visit. Elm Hill joined Instagram and Facebook this year, so check out those links too, which I'll also provide.
The iris are just finishing up. This was all tulips two or three times. You know, as soon as they get like this, we pull them out and we put a fresh one in.
So you're only using the crate once per season?
Yep.
And how many bulbs?
Well, that's what you'll be using.
Put 100, almost 100, 96. I think it's...
Wow.
9 by 12 by 7.
Wow.
It depends. A couple of the varieties have great big fat leaves or great big fat bulbs, and you can't fit that many in. Mm-hmm. And we buy a special dirt, special soil for tulips from a company up in Canada, and it is pretty much just medium.
Like
because
everything
is in the bulb.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then we cover
rooting it. You're holding in the root. And then you mulch with sand?
Well, we put some sand on top. We push the bulbs down. Well, let's go to another part and I'll show you the before that time.
When were all these a greenhouse? When did you start?
What? The tulips?
Elm Hill.
72.
Okay. Wow.
So we're getting old now. 44 years. I'm going to cut this one with...
rebuilt this right when the recession happened because we thought we needed more. We went for the first year of the recession, and instead of our sales dropping, our sales went up. And we needed this because we used to store our tulips in a different location and then have to haul them by truck. And sometimes the ground was frozen once they tipped over off the flatbed. And then we picked way over there, and we had one tiny cooler over here, and we had to use a little cart to move them. So now we grow them here, we store them here. Mm. And it's made a huge difference. So we have a machine out here. So this is a machine.
Oh, my goodness.
We fill the hopper with dirt. We put the black boxes on this tray. They slide along. Right here, this hopper drops the dirt into the box. We slide this over here and open up this room and slide inside where we are. Now we'll go there.
Okay. So this machine exists to just fill the crate with dirt.
Mm-hmm.
And do you have to have someone on constantly filling the...
We fill it with a tractor.
Okay.
We have our soil sitting right here.
Just scoop it in?
The front end loader of the tractor fills it in. We have to have a person here to put the boxes up. We sterilize the boxes before we put them up. And so that job is still a person job. And then we have 6 or 7 planters in the next area because that still takes people.
This looks like it could be like a Lucy and Alpha problem, you know, with the conveyor belt.
Uh-huh.
If you're not as fast as the conveyor belt.
We aren't. We have to turn it off and on. We just aren't on. Okay, so then we come in.
Okay,
here.
So then that feeds into this interior space.
Are our tracks in here, Joshua? No, well, so see, we open that up.
Okay.
We have a belt that goes all the way through here with tracks that goes out this door, and people are on both sides of it putting in the bulbs.
Mm. Just okay. Planting like crazy.
Yeah.
And how long will the planting take? And when do you start planting?
October, as early in October as we can, because they have to have a certain number of days cooling in order to be ready. And so far, we hardly ever get them for Christmas. We've had them only a couple of years that early. It's very hard. One, the harvest has to work out right in Holland for them to be able to harvest them early enough to go through the treatment. And there's a couple of differences, a 9-degree treatment and a 5-degree treatment. And Joshua could explain that. But you only want to get so far into this because
right.
It gets very complicated.
Yeah, it's math.
It's not just that, but, you know, you have to have a microscope to look at the bulb to know when it's at the right stage for moving out into the next part of what you're doing. So then you go out this door. So the bulb's going. We'll
okay.
Go look in there in a minute. You have to start. The bulbs arrive. We had to build a special driveway for the big truck to come. So the trucks come here and go around, and then we have a driveway out that way. Otherwise, they couldn't
do the loop.
It's enormous, huge trucks that come with the bulbs.
To deliver that.
Yeah, because they're shipped across the water, sometimes by train to here, then from New York, and then to us by truck.
And how many bulbs do you get per?
About 500,000.
Wow.
And we're the smallest grower that our broker
will work with.
Yeah. He sells to Gleckner. And Gleckner said, well, I don't want you starting to sell to my people. And Eric said, well, I do have this one grower. So he supplies us. And it's hard for him because he wants to ship a whole container load.
Right.
Which and would be millions of bulbs.
And we don't take a whole container load, so it's very hard. And sometimes our stuff is delivered to Knutson down in Puyallup because we're getting one pallet. Mm. Or 2 pallets, and they're getting 25.
Mm.
And so then we'll go down and pick that up
because
we can do that better than someone else.
Yeah.
So then you come over here, and the bulbs come out this door, and they come to this machine, and it all came as one unit from Holland. And this one is hooked up to water. You can't see it all, but it's hooked up to water.
Right.
And it sprays the bulbs.
Water's in there.
It comes over here, and it drops the sand on the bulbs. And then we have someone there that stacks them on the pallet like that.
Mm-hmm.
We stack them 8 high, which is above all of our heads. They have to have a strong man to do that job.
Right.
And then we run them into that big cooler, and we'll go see that in a minute.
And you use, like, a forklift to run them in? Or?
No, we use a pallet jack.
Oh, okay.
It's like Joshua piles them up with a forklift eventually.
But a pallet jack is sort of like a hand-operated
lift.
Automatic.
Yeah.
Ours is automatic. That's nice.
Yeah.
We have an automatic one, and so much better.
So those get pretty heavy then once they have the soil, the sand.
Oh,
yeah.
God. They're just like this, but with the bulbs too.
Yeah.
And then when the bulbs grow, then I'm assuming it's heavier, but I'm not quite sure.
How does that happen?
Yeah.
That's kind of the miracle of the bulb.
Where does
it come from?
The same thing happens with my sunflower sprouts. There's more vitamin in the sprout, which is just the seed, and we only grow it to the cotyledon stage, mm-hmm. which is in the seed, but has more vitamins and minerals than the seed.
It's those enzymes that are activated.
So all kinds of stuff happening in there. So then we take them in here.
You and the door, we should be helping you with this. All right. Should we pull it down?
No.
Okay.
We bring them in this big cooler. And we stack them floor to ceiling. The whole thing is completely filled right here to the door with those pallets stacked up.
Not vertical like this, though.
No, this is the last part. We'll come back to this and look in here when we're at that stage.
So this is...
otherwise, it would be too disjointed if we went, okay, here's this.
Yeah.
Oh, no, I need a flow chart.
Yes, exactly.
It's all in your head.
We're doing the flow chart. So then they get this cooling time in here, and that takes anywhere from 6 or 8 weeks to a few months, depending on the varieties. Certain varieties are faster than other. Hey, Joshua, what's the shortest time we do a cooling?
Shortest amount of cooling time?
Uh-huh.
Well, from the time that we get it from Holland, I don't know how long it's been.
So they're chilling the bulb.
Yeah, they're doing
that. And then they're planting, treatment. And then the chill period once it's
But done. Say you plant in October.
Yeah, the shortest, it takes 5 to 6 weeks minimum. Okay. To be ready to move into the greenhouse after that, because we want some roots to develop and we want to see a little shoot starting to come mm-hmm. up out of the bulb.
That's but why not, it's hard to get Christmas tulips.
Right.
Yeah.
But not too tall or it hits the box that's right on top of them. So it has to be just right.
Well, we're kind of, ideally we would have two different cool spaces. And I kind of did that this year. And the earlier ones, you wouldn't keep quite as cold. So they grow a little faster in the cooler, and the later ones you would keep colder to keep them short.
To slow them down.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
I'm on another part of the operation because it feels really technical to get it right.
But you started growing tulips how long ago?
Oh, 25 years ago maybe? And Ben used to do that.
Yeah.
And for a while, we just put them outside until it froze out every single one and not one of them came because... it wasn't that cold, but it was too cold for them out there in their boxes.
So when you chill them in here, what's the temperature they're at? Like just like 40 or something? Or?
Well, there's a couple of different temperatures. It starts, and it kind of depends on what's happened in Holland.
So
sometimes they'll send me a 5-degree bulb, and other times it'll be a 9-degree bulb. Mm-hmm. This year we got 7-degree bulbs.
Oh, that's what you were referring to.
Yeah.
Okay.
So then you change the temperature.
That's the temperature in
Celsius.
That they've been treating them. So then when I bring them into the cooler, I might want to have it at 48 or I might want to have it at 42 and for a certain number of weeks, and I'll kind of keep my eye on what's happening inside in the soil trays because, you can see.
You're tweaking
it. You kind of get a window into it because you...
Yeah, it's kind of a little cross-section, so you can see if roots are developing or not and just see what the progress is. It would be neat to, have a time lapse photo, take a picture every day or every couple days. And then
I'm sure there's an app for that.
Oh, yeah. We have to have a little drone.
But you would need a password.
A camera and a drone, to do it for you.
Yes, yeah. That would be fun.
So then, now they're all cool, and it's the first, the end of November, and we bring them in here.
Where they get to get toasty.
And then we raise the temperature, and they think it's spring. And this whole place was filled 2 or 3 times. This goes. This is a very long, 400 feet long.
It's like a football field length.
Yeah, we put that curtain up because we were just had this end going at the very end.
And iris are our new product this year. And we liken them quite a bit.
Have these already been harvested?
Yeah, here's some coming.
Oh, yeah.
Some of them have been harvested and some of them haven't.
What variety is this?
It's a Dutch iris. And, okay. I don't know which name
but,
it
but
is.
But it's a smaller headed iris then, right?
Yeah. I'll show you what they look like.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah.
This is because it's our first year doing iris. There's actually, you'll notice, there's a little bit difference between how many we fit in this box mm-hmm. and that box. It's much thicker.
Because you're experimenting still.
Well, no, I read what to do, and then I forgot, and we planted them in two different sets. So it was like about 8 months, or yeah, it was several weeks between plantings, mm-hmm. and by the time we got to the second planting, I had just forgotten that you don't want to plant them quite so thick.
Oh, I see. So this is the preferred spacing.
That's what was recommended in the literature I read, and this is kind of what I forgot. And we'll see what happens here. My suspicion is we'll end up with more dry flower, which is something that happens when they don't get quite enough moisture. You know, like they're competing for nutrients mm-hmm. and moisture because their root systems are so big and they're mm-hmm. sucking up water too mm-hmm. quickly. So,
but they're budding up.
Yeah, they are budding up, and you can usually tell by now if it's going to be dry flower. You can feel that there's a flower
in there.
And if it's dry flower, it'll be just squishy, like full of air.
It basically won't bloom.
Mm-hmm. It's just a wilted flower.
Got it.
Out of
mm-hmm.
it. Yeah.
And you saw in the other greenhouse where they were falling over.
Yes.
So our new solution to that is to put another box on where the bottom has been cut out to hold them.
Oh, to kind of trellis it almost.
Right. See, we're learning still on how to do this.
We'll see how the picking goes with that system. It looks like if there's something ready in the middle, it might be hard to get.
Yeah.
Would you just lift that?
You could,
off?
But once you lift it off, you'll never get it back on again.
Oh, got it.
Because there's just too many people that will get stuck in, too many flowers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Is this the end of hyacinth season, or?
This is the end of the set.
Okay.
Like, you know, so basically the intention is to bring in a fresh batch from the cooler every week or so. And I brought this in the middle of last week.
Wow. So they respond that quickly.
Well, actually what's going on, it's kind of the end of the foraging season for hyacinth. So because they've been in the cooler for so long, they're just getting taller and taller in their boxes, and they're basically blooming in the cooler. And so you bring them out here just to kind of give
finish
them a little. Yeah, finish
mm-hmm,
them up.
Mm-hmm.
But there have been years where stuff has gotten so big in the cooler that we just go down to the cooler and pick it all.
Your colors are so amazing.
Yeah.
Are you bringing in some this week?
I want to check the inventory in the cooler. And kind of
They're out in Seattle, and we don't have anything packed, so we have some packing to do.
Yeah, I put a couple on the list, but I didn't check out the mountain yet.
Yeah.
Well,
I do quite a bit.
Every Sunday.
Oh,
I always buy the hyacinths.
Well, Josh was always there. Yeah, I recognize you.
Yeah.
I do. Yesterday I felt so bad for you guys. We were there in that brief window of blue sky, but by the time we got even home, it was just like...
Yeah, it was a pretty stormy day.
It was, because it wasn't stormy here.
It was crazy. No one got struck by lightning, so I guess it could have been worse.
Yeah.
So Joshua,
people's tents were starting to take off.
Oh, I bet. So Joshua, you're working Monday through Friday here, and then you're also harvesting Saturday, and then you're going into Seattle to do West Seattle Farmers Work at Sunday. Do you ever get a day off during bulb season?
Sometimes I just don't show up to work. But no, there's like the key days are the weekends for me. So I'm working actually at the Pike Place Market on Saturday mornings, and then I bring someone down with me to drop off at University District and sell.
And then he sets up that market for them.
And then I go and collect them in the afternoon, and someone relieves me at Pike Place.
Got it.
And then sometimes I'll bring the extra inventory down the pike, and sometimes it's not mm-hmm. enough, and I just don't feel like it, and I'll go home.
Mm-hmm. And bring in the next day.
Leave it to be resorted and reprocessed mm-hmm. down here so it's looking good for the market. And then Sunday, I drop off and set up at Ballard. Then I go to Pike and drop off. And then I go over to West Seattle and set up and sell. And then I kind of do the reverse.
That's crazy.
Get it back down.
Your weekends are the intense time for
me.
For selling.
Like and then we're in the market every day at Pike, so that just, you know, I'm every day I've got a little bit of chores to do. I've got to communicate with the people in Pike, make sure the inventory's set, and, you know, coordinate either myself or another driver to go down and deliver to Pike during the week. So my schedule is during the, you know, and then there's like the housekeeping to do, like all these boxes should get moved out of here and sorted and packed and stored. And so, you know.
Right now he's fixing the wall in the other greenhouse that was brought it out. And
but then I got the sense that you're going to bring new boxes to.
At this point in the season, we're really done with the greenhouse forcing. I don't know if you went over and saw the cold frames yet. But,
not yet. We're doing step by step.
Oh, I see. So this is in the dead of winter. You're using this process,
right?
Right.
Because these are
that makes sense. Why pay the heat when the bulbs want to do it on their own time?
Yeah, I mean, we're getting up to close enough to the, you know, the normal outdoor season that with just a little bit of passive solar heating, they're coming, you know, a month early. And the next step will be, or the, you know, the next phase will be moving out into the field. So there's really a lot of different approaches to how to grow a tulip.
Crate and field grow. Cool. Well, this is fun.
So are they always on this roof just to keep it, to counter the heat?
Well, it's just to keep it moist. They get watered once a day.
Oh, okay.
And so what you're seeing is just a little residual.
Oh, I got it. Got it.
Using from the
from the previous.
You see this tubing?
Yeah.
It comes up there and comes here, and we'll do this whole side, and then just kind of put it over.
Okay, so Joshua, what is the stem length would like average? Is it about 8 to 10 inches when you cut them, or?
Well, actually, when we harvest them, we actually just pull this whole thing up like that.
Oh wow!
And then we have a machine on the other side that will actually core the bulb for us.
You were telling me that a couple of weeks ago at the market.
Yeah, so you end up with a piece of the bulb on you know, just the inside of this bulb on the stem, and then
it's the leaves, the little whitish part, right? It's
exactly. And in the bottom of it, I mean, I could do a demo for you later on if you'd like, but it leaves the leaves on the stem. So if we were to actually just cut this, you wouldn't have any leaves.
You're going to lose.
The leaves are actually attached to the bulb part of the.
Oh wow!
Does this continue to feed the flower?
Yeah.
So you're extending your vase life as well.
Well, you know, I would imagine so. There's still some good food left in that bulb. You know, and it really, I think the vase life ultimately is determined by the temperature of the room. Course, it might grow a little bit bigger and a little bit stronger and put a little more scent when the bulb's attached. But really, you know, they're so temperature sensitive. If it's 80 degrees, they're just going to bloom and be done.
Yeah.
But
these are also seem longer than the hyacinth I would grow
And that's really sort of because we've been chilling these for so long in the cooler. There's temperatures that encourage like vegetative growth, and there's temperatures that encourage flowering. And the lower temperatures seem to be the temperatures that just make them grow really slowly without developing the flower very much. And the warmer temperatures seem to bring the flowering on. So because they've been in the cooler since October, and we're just now bringing them out, they've actually grown quite a bit in the cooler.
Just naturally, even in that colder temperature. Okay. Right.
Yeah. So the cooler temperatures and watering them in the cooler has made their stems a little bit longer. And by the end of the season, they'll actually be as tall as a tulip.
Oh,
that's crazy. Boy, that's a bestseller.
Yeah,
people want that stem length.
Yeah, it makes it a lot easier to deal with. Although the stem length also, like you can see, a lot of them are falling over just in the flats, and so you get a lot of bent stems. So they really need some support around them or other flowers to prop them up. If you put them in a vase by themselves, they would just be
Yeah.
Ooh,
yeah, but
noodles.
But the color is so phenomenal. Hopefully it will make someone wouldn't turn down that apricot just because it has a bent stem.
Right.
It's so gorgeous. Displaying
them can be kind of a challenge. If you can find a container where it'll just kind of give them the support they need and they're all standing straight up, then
yeah,
no one's going to turn it down. No, it's great.
I also thought there was this thing that you somehow deprive them of light, and then when you bring them out here and there's light, that they do want to stretch for the light, and that is that a myth?
That's a technique that a lot of people use to grow all kinds of plants, is just to deprive them of the light, and it makes them, we call it leggy, mm-hmm. because they're actually, when they're deprived of light, they're actually reaching for the light. Then if they have ample light, they don't necessarily have the tendency to reach quite so much.
Okay, so bringing them in here isn't what makes it leggy. It's keeping them in the cooler, in the dark.
Right.
Got it.
Because hyacinths in the garden will bloom, you know, they're just, their noses look like they're almost blooming already.
Right.
Yeah, they're close to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And exactly.
Yeah, filled with mud.
They're not good for cuts.
What I've kind of noticed is, to get technical about it, is when the sunlight hits them, it's this solar radiation, so it's really warm, just right where the sunlight's touching mm-hmm. it, but it doesn't mm-hmm. penetrate very much. Mm-hmm. So there's just mm-hmm. this little tiny spot wherever something's in the direct sunlight where it just gets a lot warmer than all the environment around it. And that's going to bring on that bloom because it's that warmer above 60 degrees temperature where they just kind of feel like, oh, it's springtime. Got it. It's our time.
Got the memo.
Now or never.
Now or never,
And what is the temperature in here roughly? What do you get it up to?
Generally, we have it in the 60s.
Okay.
The hyacinth and iris would actually like it to be a little bit cooler, but since the main crop is tulips, mm-hmm. that's what we're what we're making the temperature for.
You can't make everybody happy, so somebody's got to compromise.
Yeah.
And
thank you. That's a good explanation.
They just come slower or faster.
Uh huh.
Okay, so now we're going to go to the greenhouse where there's actually things growing.
Okay.
Are there any particular pests? I mean, obviously you're trying to keep grass out.
Yeah, I mean...
I know the greenhouse
grower and all of them I nursery years that didn't...
I'm sure we have mice.
Well,
when you're doing a lot of germination, you see a lot of pests, but a lot of rodents, because they like the seeds
much.
We do have we have our pest control agent. You can see her right
here. Is it the cat?
Yep.
Our rodent control.
So I'm sure she is getting some stuff. And if we have a really big problem, we'll leave a little snack out for them that maybe doesn't make them feel so great.
It's so interesting to look across here and see the distinct shapes of the flower heads.
Those really round ones.
Yeah.
Let's go down there.
Yeah, that's amazing. So these are just like sacrificial heads, but they're very beautiful.
Yeah, it's a bittersweet sort of picture there.
So you're still crate growing, but then do you also grow in fields?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a middle version of the...
Yeah, I mean, this is like a space that we didn't have to heat very much. And because they're growing on the floor in a crate, their roots actually adopt some of the ground.
They pump through, right.
So this, even though it's growing in this controlled greenhouse environment, the flowers are usually more robust in here.
They look really vigorous.
Because they've been able to create a larger root system.
And then when we were talking about the specialty ones, even the variegated, I mean, those I think would take, maybe not at Pike Place Market, but if you're selling them wholesale, could you get a better price for them?
I really don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's not a whole lot of barriers between me producing a variegated tulip and someone else producing a variegated mm-hmm. tulip, other than maybe I saw an opportunity to fill a niche.
Uh-huh.
Oh,
these are beautiful. These are very...
This is called Aladdin, and it's a...
It's like a little
lily flower,
slender tulip. Little baby, huh?
Yeah, when it opens up, it's actually just a big star. It opens up all the way to flat.
Wow.
And so it's...
So it's like a single almost. That one has a nice shape.
Yeah. It's called a lily flower tulip.
Yeah.
It's a single block.
When you're selling, though, you're cutting it What do you want it to look like when you cut it?
Actually, a couple of these need to be picked. We're letting this one go a little bit longer because when it looks like this, it's really hard to know that it's going to look like that.
People need to see that little touch of yellow.
Customer education is a continual thing. You know, to have a really quality tulip, you really want it to be a little bit closed up because that's going to last a lot longer. But it's really, it doesn't carry that dramatic impulse to buy if people don't know what it's ultimately going to look like.
Or you're having to tell the story to every customer about what this
is.
You
get people that know their tulips and they'll pick all the closed ones like this.
Because they know they're going to get more.
Because they just know that they're going to open up.
Wow. How many tulips would you say were in here then?
80,000.
Good grief. And there's only one cycle for this house? They came out of the cooler. They came in here. Like when?
December.
Okay. And then you have to just irrigate them and then you don't heat the space. It's just.
There is a furnace hanging up there. I keep it above freezing so that they don't damage themselves.
Hang on a second.
And we kind of look at our outdoor supply or our indoor greenhouse, you know, heated space, and when that supply is running low, then we kind of decide when we want these ones to come. So if we add extra,
kind of tweak the heat then. Lorene, you're like almost almost eye to eye with these babies. What's the deal? You pointed those.
But the purple blush on the stem, and then the
what's the variety?
The fact that they're, you know. Damn, close to 30 inches tall. These are temple, and that's this is the orange one, and this is a yellow one. But this purple stem, I just can't.
And he was saying these right here can be up to 7 inches when they're open span.
Oh wow!
You can't stand to let this go. Hard for us to see him getting.
No, it's like when I walk into my garden and want to weed, or not want to, but feel like I must. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you've got tulips on the mind like I do. The Slow Flowers podcast has been downloaded more than 180,000 times by listeners like you. Thank you to each one of you for downloading, listening, commenting, and sharing. It means so much. If you value the content you receive each week, I invite you to show your thanks and support the Slow Flowers podcast with a donation. The button can be found on our homepage in the right column. Your contributions will help make it possible to transcribe future episodes of the podcast. Thank you to our family of sponsors, Arctic Alaska Peonies, a cooperative of 50 family farms in the heart of Alaska, providing high-quality American-grown peony flowers during the months of July and August. Visit them at arcticalaskapeonies.com. Seattle Wholesale Growers Market, a farmer-owned cooperative committed to providing the very best the Pacific Northwest has to offer in cut flowers, foliage, and plants. The Growers Market's mission is to foster a vibrant marketplace that sustains local flower farms and provides top-quality products and services to the local floral industry. Find them at seattlewholesalegrowersmarket.com. Longfield Gardens provides home gardeners with high-quality flower bulbs and perennials. Their online store offers plants for every region and every season, from tulips and daffodils to dahlias, caladiums, and amaryllis. Visit them at lfgardens.com. The Association of Specialty Cut Flower Growers, formed in 1988, ASCFG was created to educate, unite, and support commercial cut flower growers. Its mission is to help growers produce high-quality floral material and to foster and promote the local availability of that product. Learn more at ascfg.org. I'm so excited to announce that Syndicate Sales has returned as a 2017 Slow Flowers sponsor. Syndicate Sales is an American manufacturer of vases and accessories for the professional florist. Look for the American flag icon to find Syndicate's USA-made products and join the Syndicate Stars loyalty program at syndicatesales.com.
And drumroll, please, let's welcome Johnny's Selected Seeds as our newest sponsor. I can't tell you how jazzed I am to partner with this employee-owned company that brings the best flower, herb, and vegetable seeds and supplies to farms large and small. Check them out at johnnyseeds.com. I'm Deborah Prinzing, host and producer of the Slow Flowers Podcast. Next week, you're invited to join me in putting more American-grown flowers on the table, one vase at a time. And if you like what you hear, please consider logging onto iTunes and posting a listener review. The content and opinions expressed here are either mine alone or those of my guests alone, independent of any podcast sponsor or other person, company, or organization. The Slow Flowers Podcast is engineered and edited by Andrew Brenlin. Learn more about his work at kinetictreefitness.com.